Signs of the Southland, Sunday, November 5th, 2023. Gentlemen, we have football editor and editor of From the Rumble Seat in General Emeritus Joey Weaver here with us today to talk about Georgia Tech's 45-17 win over Virginia. Joey, how are you doing? How do you feel about this game?
I'm doing great. First of all, thank y'all for having me back. Always a pleasure rejoining the crew here. So glad to be here. I am fantastic. It's kind of unfortunate the way that yesterday kind of went for me because I doing parenting stuff. I actually had to like pick up and leave basically right at the end of the first quarter. I had to go to a birthday party for one of my kids' friends, and then we were in the car the whole time. So basically, I got to watch none of this game after the first quarter until, going back and rewatching it later at night to prep for a basketball conference. But it was also a little bit of an on-purpose thing of like once I stopped watching and things started going really well, it's like, well, I can't turn it on now. So yeah, I was really, really pleased with the way this game went. I mean, I honestly, I'm struggling to remember the last time that they played an ACC game like this where it was just like a totally. A pretty much a stress-free second half. Like that was really a nice treat.
There
Yeah.
was
I
that.
mean,
Go ahead.
I was gonna say that it gave pretty strong there's one game, I think it was a Duke homecoming game. That I was like, up, Davey P. He finally figured it out. Jeff Collins and the boys, 66-24, or whatever the actual final score was in that one. I was like, oh, they did the thing. And they did not wind up doing the thing. But I think ruminating on the same point, it has to have been at least 2 or 3 years since then.
Yeah, it's been I don't really remember because but my most of my undergrad was Jeff, and so like going into a game like this hasn't really been a thing I've been able to totally experience. I guess the last Paul year was 2018, which is the last time we had a winning record, and so like there were some games like that, but I was not as zoned in on this team as I am now. So yeah, that was like when we were up threes, when we were up 31-10, I'm like, yeah. I feel remarkably comfortable right now. Like Calandria was showing nothing. The defense was doing enough. The turnovers were coming, and we at any moment someone could run for 55 yards, which is becoming a trend. At any moment, someone could run for 55 yards and set up either an actual touchdown or a Burr field goal or something. Like there's the explosive plays on this team are becoming far more regular than I think any of us expected we'd see.
I
Before
think
we
that's uh
continue the
oh, go
conversation,
ahead, go ahead.
real-time follow-up. The game that Jake is talking about is a 56-33 demolition of Duke during the cursed COVID year.
I think I was there.
That would have been the weekend. I think that would have been the weekend after, or the weekend of Clean Old Fashioned 8, had it happened that year, which is just a very weird parallel. In what again was a very cursed season. Sorry, Mr. Grant, continue.
That Duke
No,
team,
no.
by the way, in like 10 games, they turned it over like 42 times. And I was in the stands that night counting out the turnovers, like I was the count from Sesame Street, like one, two, three. I think there were five turnovers in that game from Duke. I remember that.
Honestly, it felt kind of similar. Not totally similar yesterday, but Tech came up pretty big a couple times in the turnover department, I would say. There were certainly things about the defense, even up against second and third line quarterback play for a decent chunk of it that made me go, I don't know. Two red zone interceptions, a big fumble on what otherwise would have been a fresh set of downs for Calandria and the gang. And also another interception that should have maybe actually, I don't know, counted from face. I put this out there in the Slack. Did they send this ref squad to learn how to call face mask school last week or something? Because like that's way more face mask penalties than I've seen in a long time. Or
I mean,
I don't know. I don't know.
were they legit? I think they were legit based on what I saw in live time. There were some really there now to your point of like they were just fresh off of it and wanted to call all of them. There were some like half second face masks that they were calling that were just like, whoa, okay, you could have maybe there may be some wiggle room there, but they're just as soon as there was a hand to face, they were just calling it. So
20 years
that'll
ago
be.
would have been the incidental face mask 5-yard penalty that it's easy to forget that that used to exist.
That makes sense. Why they should bring that back? I like that idea.
Yeah, it seems like, yeah, incidental is a good way to describe a lot of, like, it didn't seem like, you know, somebody's trying to commit a personal foul. And I feel like you see that in a decent number of cases, but that's probably a topic for a different podcast.
So I see five face masks, and then one that came on the sack that I think you're referring to, the 4th and 16 sack that negated a 12 yard sack. So womp womp.
I was like, one of the last plays I saw when I was watching the game live that I remember was Calandria. I think it was on 3rd and 11 or something like that, late in the first quarter. And he's extending the play, rolling. Finally just throws up like a 500-looking jump ball into the middle of like three defenders. Cornelius Tatum comes down with an interception. Tex got the ball back. Except he was already being tackled near the sideline. A second defender comes over, and in the process of the second defender going after him, commits the face mask penalty. Yeah. I was like, are you kidding me? Come on, guys.
I think that may have been Zeke or one of the main linebackers on that one. Yeah, that was
ESPN listed as Mikiah Scott.
Okay.
So that's what I got. Yeah. I think this was, I mean, I'm going to pair a lot of the stuff that y'all are saying just from the, like, the advanced stats perspective. I think it was a really solid game, especially offensively. Haynes King, again, like a very solid outing. He didn't have, Joey, I think you noted this on Twitter as well. He didn't have a lot of turnover worthy throws. So PFF actually really, really liked him this week, which matched what we have, for EPA per play. He put up, 0.15 EPA per dropback. I don't have his EPA per rush in front of me right now, but on the rushing side of the ball, 0.33 EPA per rush for the entire backfield, mainly made up of King's designed runs and scrambles. And then you have Dante Smith playing a major role today. And then Jamal Haynes, again, playing a really big part of the rush game again. So really, really good performance from your skill positions there. Just to benchmark that, that EPA per dropback is, the EPA per dropback for the game entirely is 0.07, because that includes a very, very bad couple of plays from Zach Pyron late in the game, which is fine. That's 56th percentile in the nation overall. I'm sure if those weren't included, it'd be quite a bit higher. EPA per rush is 91st in the nation. Obviously, you know, there's a little bit of difference there because a bunch of the game was played in garbage time. So you got to consider that. But I mean, if I threw out garbage time, I'm sure it would look pretty good.
As a pyromaniac myself, I do think it is important to point out one limited in-game experience for not only him this year, but also a bunch of other players that were around him at that time. I don't think you can, whether it's running backs, offensive linemen, receivers, like that's meh. I think he just kind of tossed it out.
He just threw two incomplete passes. That's really all it took.
Yeah, nothing much. Haynes King's, game incomplete. Haynes King's rushing EPA per play was 1.29, most of anybody in any kind of offensive category. Dominic Blaylock's passing EPA per play was 1.11.
Is that good? Adding 1.25 points per play every time you run the ball, that seems pretty good.
I'm told that's very good, actually. to read out the full stat line for King on the rushing side of the ball, 6 carries, 84 yards, and 2 touchdowns. The touchdowns are where you're going to make most of your money on the EPA per play there. And then on the in the air, 2 for 29. I think it was actually 2 for 30, but we're missing one of those incompletions, maybe just due to ESPN data. 207 TD and a sack. And again, that's 0.15 EPA per play, 4.47 passing EPA for him total. So all in all, like a very successful day for him. And again, I think the major key, not to do a pun, but the major key for him that's been different from a lot of other games that Tech has had, he's limited those turnover-worthy plays, right? I think that's where Tech has been bitten in the past. And that's why you see those two – I don't have the chart in front of me, but at CFB Numbers on Twitter, we'll always on Sundays, we'll tweet out a chart of PFF passing grade on the x-axis and EPA per play on the y-axis, or their flip. Anyway, what have you. This week, those 2 points have put Haynes King in the top right quadrant where you really want to be, where both really of those stats are good.
Yeah. Like top of the top right too. Like he was.
Yeah. I mean, I think Jaden Daniels was up there. Some other really good quarterback performances from this week. Again, I don't have it in front of me, so I can't comment really specifically, but
one other thing I'll mention too is like his accuracy numbers just for the raw numbers, 22 of 29, like that looks quite good. And actually, I think he got shorted a little bit because I think he had a couple of drops thrown in there too of other passes that were on the money and should have been caught, but just kind of just got dropped. So it looks good. It should have looked even better. I thought he was really sharp yesterday.
Yeah, and I think that's a good thing to point out there is, you know, this game, you know, we noted kind of, or I noted previously, the interception that wasn't on the face mask, but also the drops that were too, you know, right? It's football, right? So you're not going to get every play, or you're not going to have every play be clean. But I think Georgia Tech, even for the flaws that we may find in the performance, really acquitted themselves well. And in terms of the defense, you know, they didn't always get monster stop on the ground right off the bat or something, but for the most part, they tightened it up in a drive and were able to, you know, force a stop or get UVA off schedule. And the same thing goes on the offense, right? There were a couple monster plays in there too, but in general, you know, pretty reliable couple yards on the ground, pretty reliable couple yards on a screen or a short pass, you know, through the air. And honestly, the only problem with King scoring two beautiful rushing touchdowns is that he didn't get to throw them and get closer to that record. But all in all, it feels like a textbook, like total team win type thing. And it's very refreshing to say that at about a 5-4 Georgia Tech football team on November 5th, 2023. It feels like it's been a long time since we've been generally positive and just, yeah, here's what's up kind of
situation. And that 5-3, that 5-4 mark is important because I think as someone else noted earlier, it's one win away from a bowl game. They're on the precipice of doing something that they haven't done since Tech marched up to Detroit in the December of 2018 and played Minnesota in the Quick Lane Bowl, right? It's and I think, Jake, this is something that you said it last week, or maybe it was the week before, but it's an opportunity that a lot of students currently on campus have never seen. They've never had the experience of going to the postseason, even if it's the Quick Lane Bowl, even if it's the Belt Bowl or what have
granted,
you.
Granted, the only thing worth remembering about that bowl as somebody who was there was that Presley Harvin boinked a punt, I think in warmups, off of the scoreboard. Other than that, throw it all out.
Yeah, well, not
they
that
won
it was
seven games in the regular
good.
Season, you know?
Yeah.
Not like, that it was a particularly good bowl game. I mean, I think, honestly, the most memorable part of that bowl season was getting absolutely deked by the formerly known as Belk Bowl. That was not a fun God. Moment.
Yeah, that was trash.
If they
I
send us
that.
There this year, I'm going to be real mad.
It's a short trip for us, at least.
The only thing I remember about that bowl game is that we wore all blue in Paul's last game as a coach for us, which
you know that bothered him. You know bothered him.
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
They wore blues for the, they wore gold for the Gator Bowl, didn't they?
Yeah,
they wore
some sort
of color.
Yeah, they wore gold.
I do want to point out one thing: Paul Johnson back in the stadium with good vibes. And all of a sudden, Georgia Tech's offense has turned into monsters. And like, I don't know. I feel like as a Georgia Tech fan who came of age during the Paul Johnson era, it feels as if the air has been cleared in a lot of different ways. And I don't know if that's just me writing something I want to exist into being true, or if it's like, hey, maybe this might work. You know, like
it was clear whatever bad voodoo we had kind of went away after we rushed for 400 gazillion yards against North Carolina, the second most we've rushed against a Power 5 team, which I'm like, Paul, you didn't do that? Like, come on, man. It was so, yeah, it's insane. It feels right. Wes at Bloghawk, or the Hawks SB Nation site who used to write for us, also like noted the same thing, was like, wait a second. He comes back and everything is back to rights. So yeah, it feel also just like having a good rush, like opens up everything in your playbook too, which is not a thing we could have really said was possible for a long time too. So, and now we have like a legit, now it's like a real quarterback too doing it, and not Tobias Oliver or whoever else it was back in the day.
I won't. Tobias, okay, look,
Tobias
look,
had
look,
a
look.
Great 2018 season with some good memes.
I am not a...
This is some slander. That Virginia Tech game is one of... you know the one I'm talking about, Joey.
I know.
Thursday night game when we scored like a million points. That and the
Louisville the same play 30
year,
times.
Running my, yeah. Oh, my gosh. I was like, this guy's going to win the Heisman, but that obviously he did not.
They did. Well, there was also the immediately after that 2017 Tennessee game, there was the whole Taquan for Heisman movement, which I remember. God. I mean, it wasn't so much of a movement as a meme, but what are memes? But just small movements. And
well,
at the end
he,
of the day,
rush enough yards to go from McCamish all the way to Bobby Dodd or
something
like that.
Like
in
that. He was,
or something like that.
It was an
That's
absurd.
So That's
oh my
funny.
God, this game has us remembering dudes now.
Look what it's done.
Let me bring it home. Let me bring this home to the point that you were making before. Like there is a certain sense that the air has been cleared, right? But they're doing it in a different way from how they were doing it under Paul, right? They still have a similarly strong rushing attack, but they're getting a lot more production in the air out of Haynes King. And actually, while y'all were talking, I wanted to look this up. Where would you guess that Haynes King ranks in the nation in terms of QBR?
I feel like I may have seen this, but I'm going to guess 15th.
That's the ESPN cooked up quarterback rating stat. I don't know, 18th.
Give me 7.
19th. He's 19th. 76.9 QBR. Above him in the ACC. I'm doing this live, so you're going to have to give me a minute. Drake May at 15. I think that is it, unless conference realignment has happened before my very eyes. I believe that's it. He's the highest rated quarterback in QBR in the ACC and 19th in the nation. I'll throw another log on this fire here. King was 7th in this week alone, 95.0 QBR. You're getting a lot of, I think that narrative about the air being cleared and them actually getting that production out of the passing game now, which is something they didn't have for years by design under Paul Johnson, and then years because of shambolic everything under Jeff Collins, is now there. They're actually getting that production out of it, and they're experiencing a level of success on the field that we haven't seen since 2018. And I think that's admirable. Joey, I know you only have a couple more minutes left, so I want to make sure I get some of your thoughts on next week's game versus Clemson. That is Saturday, November 10th at Clemson. That's a noon kickoff on ABC for those wondering. How did Clemson look versus, I believe they played Notre Dame yesterday? How'd they look, and what are you looking forward to in this matchup?
So if you just watch the scoreboard, you would have thought that Clemson was boat racing Notre Dame. You would have thought that, like, Clemson's putting it all together. They figured it out. I don't think that's the exact whole story there. I think there was some Notre Dame sloppiness that really contributed to that, gave Clemson some real easy points there. Mm-hmm. I'd have to go back and find the box score again to remember. We were doing basketball conference last night, and I believe we said that they scored 31 points, and I think 17 of them were fairly cheap. You had a muffed punt that led to a short touchdown drive from Notre Dame. You had a pick six. There was like 17 cheap points in there that Clemson's offense scored, I think. Clemson's defense legit very good. Moving the ball will be difficult, and if Haynes King does not stay away from the turnover-worthy plays, it's going to be a long day, I think. But if you can play a clean game and play one of your better games, I think they got a shot next weekend. This Clemson team, I feel like, has been a bit of a mess at times this year, at least offensively. And in a low-scoring game, it's like I think anything can happen here. Cade Klubnik has been very unimpressive for most of what I've seen this year, I'd say. So I saw the line came out today at 18. I want the points.
That feels insane. That feels insane. I would guess like 9 or 10 instead of that much. That's a good bet.
And I want to bounce off of Joey's point about the boat race, cheap points type deal. In the end, it was only an 8-point margin. I believe it was 31-23. And if you think about it, that pick six was 7 of those points right there. This is a Notre Dame team that got handled by Louisville in basically all phases of the game. And a team that, yes, Louisville has improved, I'd say, since week one. Somebody who's watched a decent amount of Louisville, Notre Dame, Clemson, Georgia Tech, just from, you know, various interests and ACC-ishness.
Yep.
I don't think that you can really, you know, transitive property your way around the sport too much, but it doesn't make me unconfident, if that's a fair way to put that, right? Like, Georgia Tech maybe can hang with the Louisville. I mean, I think Georgia Tech has improved since then too. And I think it's going to come down to, you know, keeping the playbook open, limiting those turnovers. And obviously turnover luck the other way does a huge thing to set things up for an offense. And, you know, that getting the ball out of the other team's hands might help us out. So
if you told me that Georgia Tech goes +2 in turnovers or better in this game, I would say at least a 50% chance to win. Like,
yeah, agreed. Especially if we got a good field position, because Aiden Burr, sir, only kicks field goals accurately. Currently 12th in the nation with 90.
Not touchbacks, though. We learned that yesterday.
Not touch. We did learn that. There's two things. The only two blemishes I had from yesterday is don't have Aiden Burr do the kickoffs and Eric Singleton dropped a couple balls he shouldn't have dropped. That's all I have on the actually negatives.
As long as he gets it out of his system this week, you know, that's how that works, right?
Yeah.
It's like saving runs in a baseball game.
Yeah.
That is how that works. So a couple of points that I wanted to add as well. I mean, talking about that turnovers, if Tech does go +2, you say, like, common analytics wisdom is like turnovers are like worth 5.5 points, let's say. That's 11 points right there on an 18-point-ish margin. I think you're right on the money with saying that that probably makes it a 50-50 game. And back on the point about Klubnik, he was not good. Versus Notre Dame. I don't know what the weather conditions were like in this game.
Beautiful. I think they're fine.
They were ideal. Not a cloud in the sky.
Yeah.
Both of these quarterbacks were awful. Legitimately terrible. Wind. Both of them were sub 0.5 EPA per dropback. Klubnik specifically 13 of 26, 109 with a touchdown, a pick, and a sack. It was not good. It was exceptionally not good. He's been fine for the year overall. I think I just looked it up. He's been 0.11 EPA per play or EPA per dropback, excuse me, in the air. So it'll be interesting to see what Tech has to try to keep him at the same level that Notre Dame did. Obviously, they don't have the same type of horses, and they've had some issues with along with being stylistically a very bend don't break defense. I think some of those came to play. Versus UVA, we've seen that at times this year. It's going to be a very interesting matchup, and I think I agree. For the first time in years, this feels like a, if not a winnable game, but like one you can sort of squint at and see Tech has a shot here instead of it being an impossible situation, right?
Yeah,
I would say it's not a hopeless situation, and some of that is Georgia Tech, I think, improving a little bit from what we've seen. And I think a decent amount of it is Clemson coming back down to earth from what we've seen. And so I think kind of that meet in the middle is like, it could completely get away from Georgia Tech. You get a couple of early turnovers, you know, get buried and that's it. But again, you play a clean game and you do your thing. I think you're going to have a shot.
Another day where it's going to be a lot of high variance of, we have no idea. Mm-hmm. Gotta love it. Gotta love it.
The high variance team is back. After two wins in a row, they're going to do some really weird stuff in Death Valley. Thank you again, Joey, for joining us today. Where can the people find you?
I'm on Twitter at FTRS Joey. Still repping the site with my Twitter handle. We're on Basketball Conference is the name of the podcast. We cover all the ACC's football action. So go find us either on, you know, wherever you find audio podcasts, iTunes, Spotify, you know, Google, Amazon, whatever. Or we're on YouTube, youtube.com/@theaccfootballpodcast. We've been doing live streams both for previews and recaps the last few weeks. So been a lot of fun. Come join us there. Hit the subscribe button, jump in the comments, and join in the conversation.
Thank you for joining us.
Anytime you want to come back, sir. Great having you.
Absolutely. Thanks, guys. I'll catch you later.
We'll be back to talk about the rest of the fall sports in action right after this short break.
As always, this fine podcast is brought to you by Section 103, the internet's finest purveyor of Georgia Tech apparel. We've talked about some of their new stuff lately, as, of course, Joe Hamilton jersey looks great. Haynes King, Zach Pyron, Dante Smith. It's perfect time of year to support those lads, but they have all of the great Georgia Tech designs that you know and love available for purchase as well. You can check them out at section103.com, at section103 on Twitter. And as always, free shipping on orders over $70 every day. Back to you guys.
Well, Mr. Grant, it's actually back to you to talk about Georgia Tech cross country. They were off this past week after the ACC championships, but NCAA regional championships are coming up next weekend. So tell me a little bit about how this works.
Yeah, for sure. So NCAA regionals are kind of interesting. It's somewhat similar to golf, actually, where they kind of group teams into, I think it's 8 or 10 different regionals, and they send you to not necessarily the nearest one, but a geographically contiguous zone that includes your region. For example, there's a Madison regional, universities based in Chicago get sent to Stillwater. I don't really know why. They just kind of do what they do. Anyways, Georgia Tech's in the South region. There are several ranked teams and teams of note in the South region. On the men's side, Alabama, Tennessee, and Florida State are currently ranked. The women are running against Florida, Tennessee, Alabama, Lipscomb, and Ole Miss. So essentially your state of Georgia, most of Tennessee, and points south from there. That being said, the way regionals works is the top two teams in any regional get an automatic invite to the NCAA. So those will be up in Charlottesville. So as the men and the women both head down to the University of Florida to go compete in Gainesville, they must pass two of, on the men's side, Tennessee, FSU, and Bama, aforementioned, in order to get one of those automatic spots, or the women must pass four of Florida, Tennessee, Alabama, Lipscomb, and Ole Miss. So kind of got their work cut out for them. There are also 13 at-large bids, and the top four non-invited team individuals do get an invite to Charlottesville as well down this weekend in Gainesville. They'll run the Mark Bostick Golf Course. That's a course that Tech is, I would say, probably reasonably familiar with. UF usually hosts on their golf course. Actually, a lot of schools host cross-country races on their golf courses. The start times, I notice they're by far the earliest of any regional. I'm sure there's probably some, you know, temperature and weather concerns there, but the ladies will get going at 8:30 in the morning Eastern for their 6K. The men will get started at 9:30 a.m. Eastern for the 10K. Those are standard distances across the country, and we'll have to see what shakes out from there.
Let's go over to Jack to talk about Georgia Tech golf, which was in a very weird split squad, competition that we discussed last week. Mr. Purdy, yeah, what do you have for me on the East Lake Cup?
East Lake side, we had a winner for day one. They had an individual port, that, as with most of these college golf competitions, first phase is individual, add up all the team strokes, and then go into match play format. So that first day, Cale Fontenot was the individual champ with a 468. So once again, big tournament, good teams. A Tech person comes out nearly or on top and on top. The team as a whole got third of the four teams. So we faced UNC in the semifinal as the three seed, and we lost 3-2, although two matches were in extra holes when we were down 2-1. So we had a shot to pull it off and just barely didn't. So that was North Carolina winning 3-2 after we beat them 3-2 at NCAAs in the semis in May. So sad one there. And then we won our consolation match next day against Florida. So a reversal of what happened in May. Thankfully, this wasn't the actual championship or anything like that. But we're facing really good teams that on any given day could beat us. And on any given day, we could beat them. So we got a little bit of both, and we got a trophy of some sort out of it. So that was cool.
I will say Cypress Point, the split squad action, Tech did finish eighth out there in Cypress Point. They were up against Illinois in the seventh, eighth place match. Andy Mao, he did score a point in that seventh, eighth match, but they did fall 5-1 to Illinois. Adam Bratton lost 3-2. Aiden Kramer 2-1. Aiden Tran 3-2. Brady Rackley 3-1. And Colson Brown, who I don't think we talked about last week, did finish 9 down with 7 to play in, I would say, one of the more interesting stories that we've had so far this year. But you guys be the judge on that.
I mean, it's a pretty fascinating one. A guy from North Augusta High School in South Carolina. Yes, it's that Augusta that you're thinking of. It walks onto Georgia Tech's football team as a freshman quarterback and then gets called over to the golf team to make a roster for their cross-country trip. It's fascinating. It's fascinating. I think another fascinating piece of that is Benjamin Reuter, who's a junior, is redshirting this year. I don't know if we mentioned that last year. He's the guy that's
redshirting. Could be injury concerns or something like that, you know?
It was interesting to me because he didn't factor in a ton in last year's lineups as well. So it's curious.
It's not, very curious. Think of it strategically. I mean, basically our entire core is still here from last season, and if they're going to be up there doing all that, it's not the work. And knowing Tech is Tech, and a purely academic year will not hurt him in the slightest, and he can help lead the charge with the new group of kids afterwards. I like the strategy just from that angle.
I did want to say, tying it back to football just a little bit, Brent Key was asked about that in the press conference last week. I don't know if it was the early one or the later one, but he was asked about, like, hey, how'd this come up? Essentially, he had very complimentary things to say about Coach Hepler, who obviously is a phenomenal coach and all that. But he also didn't close the door on, like, if there's needs elsewhere, like, our guys are here, which, I mean, you got some pretty speedy guys, maybe track type situation, or folks who, you know, come up playing baseball or something else in a time of need. So I don't know. I think that's a sign of, I'd say, an interesting cohesion. And I at least like seeing that. So, you know, maybe I'm being a little bit starry eyed for sentimentality or whatnot there, but I think it's a pretty cool concept of, you know, hey, like, we're an athletic department, we're a team amongst the different teams. I do want to round out with Cypress Point. It was an interesting match play scenario. They played foursomes on the first day. So Tech did go, they lost 2-1 on day one to Texas. Round two was four ball. So also interesting to see that Tech went 1-1-1 against Auburn. I guess that's how it worked. I don't know how they broke that tie. Maybe that's because was 2-1 was a better margin for Auburn. I don't know. I'm honestly not familiar enough. I'm going to be straight up with that. And then the round three was the singles, your classic match play a la NCAAs or the ACC title. So just interesting to see. I think golf is really moving towards more opportunities to do that. And we saw it twice this week. So I'm all for it. I think it makes for a pretty compelling, stressful, but that's what gets you to watch the match, right? That's the same way that kind of like rally versus side out scoring in volleyball, right? Like the new is more stressful, and it makes for a pretty compelling product. And granted, that was now 20 years ago, and nobody asked me when I was five about, you know, that change, but
we'll go back in time.
That parallel I would find. Yeah.
Well, we'll ask for your 5-year-old opinion eventually. We'll almost have the technology. I'm certain of it.
Exactly.
Exactly. Mr. Grant, you now have the con for men's tennis. They were at both the ITA Fall Championships, and they hosted a fall invite this past week. There's a lot of results, so just hit me with the high level ones here.
Number one point. Still don't know where Andres Martin and Marcus McDaniel are.
Still in
Keshav Chopra. I don't know. They're not on any of these lists. They're out there somewhere, I'm sure, having a great old time. But they were not at any of these events. I checked. That was the first thing I went for yet again.
Not still in, what was it, Turkey? Was it
Tunisia?
Tunisia.
Tunisia. But between between men's tennis, women's tennis, and golf. These all represent their last events of the semester before Thanksgiving and holiday break, finals, all that good stuff. So just one general note for men's and women's tennis as well as golf. In terms of the men's tennis team, Richard Biagiotti and Gabriel Brancatelli fell to Jeremy Casaubon and Nathan Cox of Vanderbilt out at ITA Fall Championships in San Diego. That was a 6-3, 6-1 two-setter doubles match out there. They were the only boys in action from Tech out there. The women, I don't believe I saw any ITA results there. So nothing to write home about there. That said, the GT Fall invite did happen for the men as well. They played singles, a number of them. I'd say it was a mixed bag. We did see a 2-0 finish from Bauer. That was 2-0 over a... This is too many results to read. I can't go into all this detail, but we'll keep it high level. A lot of these are New Mexico or Liberty. There's a couple Yale, Bama, and UGA sprinkled in there as well. So just use that... I guess use your imagination for the rest of it. Bauer 2-0, Chakri 0-2, Aurora 1-1, DeMuth 0-1. Rowan Sokdev did go 1-1, including a win over the boys from Athens. So that's always nice to see. That was 7-5, 6-1 in doubles. Aurora and DeMuth went 0-1 against a split squad pairing, split between half New Mexico and half Alabama. So don't really know how that came about, but you know, it's fall tennis. We do some interesting stuff sometimes, I guess. Aurora and Sokdev to fall to a duo from New Mexico, 8-4, while Bauer and Chakri did go 1-1. Their win came 8-2. Again, these are long sets for the norm in terms of tennis, and an 8-4 loss to pair from Mississippi State. As far as the women go, they were down in Miami at the Miami Fall Invite. Most of their results are against Northwestern or Berry College. Kind of interesting. I feel like it's something we see in cross-country track and swimming, but not so much interdivisional levels of play in terms of, you know, in tennis and things like that. All that said, Kara Lee, currently ranked number 9 in the nation, went 2-0, both two-set wins. Kylie Bilchev, who's 28th in the country, had a two-set win and a three-set win. Mahak Shane, number 81, went 2-0, both two-setters. Gibbon Roach went 1-1. The loss was a three-setter. The win was also a three-setter, including a 7-6 tiebreak win and winning 6-0 going home against Sydney Pratt of Northwestern. So good job there. Kate Sherbura went 2-0. Those were also of note, given that those were both two setters and she only dropped a total of 4 games across 4 sets. So bravo. That's truly dominant. So good job. And that's all against Northwestern. So Power 5 competition there. Mira Jasudasen went 1-1, both two setters. Ruth Marsh went 1-1, including a three set loss to Autumn Rabjohns of Northwestern. In doubles, more of a mixed bag. There was 0-2 finish for Ruth Marsh and Mira Jasudasen. Interestingly, they saw Brittany Lau of Northwestern twice on two different pairings there. Go figure. It's fall tennis. Interesting stuff. Kara Lee and Kate Sherbura went 1-1. Their loss was to Bella Fenning and Xinyi Nong from Miami, 6-2. Their win was against Sydney Pratt and Maria Shusharina from Northwestern. Gibbon Roach and Kylie Bilchev did go 1-1 as well. That's a lot of talking, but that's a lot of tennis. So, you know.
I have.
Oh, and none of these count day 3 from Tech or Miami. So there's another day out there. We'll see what happens.
The only thing that I have is that I want to make sure that I note this for the record. It's not Berry College, like the one that's in like Northern Georgia. It's Barry. It's a private Catholic university in Miami, founded in 1940 by the Adrian Dominican Sisters, one of the largest Catholic universities in Southeast. Interesting. I guess they just pulled in someone local to take a crack at it. I mean, it was It was good competition, right? It was Miami, yeah. Northwestern, Barry, and then Tech. So very successful day there. Mr. Purdy.
Yes, sir.
Let's talk about what has been an enthralling week in volleyball. Let's start with the headliner. Georgia Tech 3, number 3 Louisville 1 at O'Keefe Gymnasium on Friday. Give me the high level, like kind of the high level game flow of this. How did this unfold?
So we talked last week and beforehand, like, so this needed to play out like how we played against Pitt, where we went up 2-0 with highly explosive offense and then just carry that as long as you can. Sadly, against Pitt, we flamed out super tragically in the last three sets and lost that. Same thing. I missed last year's game when Louisville came to town, but I assume it was kind of similar because I knew we got reverse swept and we were up and then stuff just went sideways. So I think we were all pretty scared about that. What we got was the best performance by our middle blockers all season. We got some utterly insane, jaw-dropping serving by Bianca Bertolino. Like, I've never seen better serving in my life. And we've seen, like, we've had the best teams outside of, like, Wisconsin and Nebraska come play in O'Keefe the last couple of years. And we saw the defense do its job. Like, all three phases were there. And we pulled it off. We actually pulled it off. This team has been trying to beat Louisville since 2017. That was the last time we had their number. And we lost them in the Elite Eight. They barely got us last year and O'Keefe, and it's just been that mound that they've been needing to climb and trying to climb for ages and ages. And you need to win this game to win the ACC. Like, there's just no way around it.
I mean, it's just been a massive monkey on their back.
I think getting this match felt, winning that match, I think, for them felt better than any potential like round of 16 or Elite Eight win.
And it wasn't getting this.
It's the combination of the monkey off the back and the fact that it was at home in front of your own fans. And importantly, this is still not a complete Georgia Tech team.
No, that was what was shocking. Yeah.
Their best middle blocker is out.
Yeah.
When is she coming? When is Liv Mogridge back? I don't know. And dare I say, this is probably Tech's best blocking performance they've had all season.
Oh, easily. No, it absolutely was.
At least based on vibes.
Yeah, I would agree. Like, they played some like bad teams who they were able to block easily, but like, yeah, this was, I was truly shocked. Like, I was very ready. I was emotionally ready walking into the building, expecting maybe we get one set just because the offense works, but our blocking's not there to beat Anna DeBeer and Aiko Jones, and they're absolute powerhouse of a team. And then it worked. Like, we had, that was the best game by DeAndre Pierce all year, the best game by Anna Bosie all year. Smiley Manning played a ton of points. Her best game, not her best game all around all year, I would say. She's had some better offensive games. It just worked. I think what I realized after the fact, and what some people helped me realize, is Louisville, not the tallest team. Tall teams have been a kryptonite for us. Louisville was not exactly that. Like, Georgia was able to kill us because of that. Like, we just could not get over the net against them. Louisville did not play like that. So I want to note that Bertolino had 7 aces in the match. If you weren't there, you need to find the replay on Twitter of when she finishes the first. We're down 24-20 in the first set. She's on the service line and she hits 4 aces in 6 points and wins us the set on back to back aces. The first one just barely clipping the line. The second one, we tweeted a screenshot of this. It was a full like 3 feet in. Louisville was so on their heels and just destroyed by the crowd at that point. Like, they just were frozen. I don't think it mattered where that ball went, if as long as it got over the net, they weren't touching it. Bertolino was in such a groove. And she said after the match, she's like, I knew I had to hit that ball as hard as I could. Like, there was nothing else going on in my head outside of just kill it. So yeah, find those replays. I have never been I don't know about you guys. You've been to more matches than I've been to. I've never been in O'Keefe at a louder moment than when that set-winning ace landed.
It's close. It's certainly close for me. I think coming back to beat Notre Dame in a reverse sweep in 2019, that is the most packed I've ever felt that building. And I think that might be the loudest, like, sustained for a whole match. But in terms of, like, single moments, that's got to be up there. I mean, gosh, I've probably been to 100 matches there at this point. Like, it's definitely up there.
It was nuts. I also want to note there was somewhat of a tactical change done in this match that Kali noted after the match. Also, Tech Volleyball has like a full-time SID that's not just also their social media manager. So now we have like post-game availability, which is fantastic. And Kalia noted they actually intentionally had Smiley Mannion playing right side for a lot of the match when they put the 6-2 in. And so they had a new look that was not normal, that no one had seen before, and it worked, which is awesome. So freaking awesome.
Yeah, and to add to that, actually, this was mentioned on the Notre Dame broadcast by Andy Demetra, that the entire game plan from Kalia in that game was to set up the middles and kill Louisville that way. Just make sure that you're attacking the center of the court and feeding Pierce and Mannion and whoever else is in that rotation, Bozy,
yeah,
in that rotation in the center of the park, and avoid the outside hitters and the blockers for Louisville, right? Because if you get into a situation where you're staring Anna DeBeer in the face, that's probably not going to work out well for you, actually.
Yeah.
And DeBeer wasn't looking all that good.
That's the point that I was going to come to. Yeah. She was 0.00, I think, for on hitting.
Yeah, she hit even. She was flat. And when the times that they were able to set her up like in system, it was like, oh my god, this girl is amazing. But yeah, the game plan worked where they were kind of able to keep the ball out of her hands. Iko Jones is one of their best players too, and like wasn't playable for them for a lot of that match as well. It was just
they took her out. I think we talked about this while the game was going on. At one point, they subbed her out and kept her out for a while. Like the majority, I think, set two. They just saw that it wasn't working for her. And I think one of the other things too, for Tech, when it comes to Anna DeBeer, did a really good job of shifting that block around order to get numbers on her and limit how she could perform. And so she had to go over the top of the block a lot in order to try to get points. And it was constantly, she was overhitting it, right? She wasn't able to get the touch on the ball in order to put it around because she was just trying to get through the block. And it just sailed out of bounds a ton. So it was just not like, it was a very weird performance from DeBeer. I wouldn't say it's a particularly characteristic one, judging from what we know of her all the time. But this season, she's been due for a stinker or two every couple of weeks or so. I was looking at her WPA page on HuskerGeek.com. Or win probability added page, and every couple of weeks or so she has like a very weird like 0.29 game instead of a 0.5, or she's like usually at like a 0.5 level. A couple weeks ago versus BT she was at minus 0.1, which was shocking for me to look at given her reputation. So you might be able to chalk it up to, DeBeer had a sinker. Iko Jones was the American version of unplayable. But Tech was able to defend both of those options well and keep the ball out of their hands for the most part, right? Yeah. They didn't want those two players deciding the game. But I will say that when Louisville had opportunities, when Tech had a series of errors that went against them, especially in that third set, which Louisville won.
Third set was not good.
Louisville played more of they played more of that cross court game, right? They tried to set horizontally, get Tech's block moving, and then when they did get Tech's block on the edge, they would shoot cross court. I'm making this motion to the guys. You can't see this on audio podcast. It's a visual medium, after all, but. They would shoot cross court to try to take advantage of the space where players weren't. And they were finding a lot of success doing that, not only like immediately next to the net. I think that's where they tried to dump that ball right before the first line on the court, which I can't remember. It's like 3 foot line. And then eventually they started getting into that mid range too, where there was a lot of space. So that was where Louisville found a lot of success. If I rewatched the game, I would say that that's probably what they were trying to do the entire time, to try to take advantage of that kind of lack of mobility. Because I think Tech has had a lot of issues with that during the course of the season. In some games they're just not able to get across horizontally as effectively. But in this game, they were able to shift really well and take advantage of of the space sort of in the center of, like we said, they set up the middles really well and were able to take advantage of the space in the middle of Louisville's defense, which was really good.
That was, that was the whole game plan. They did it. That third set was bad. We lost 25-17. We had a negative hit percentage in that set. Like, it just,
and that's where you thought it could go wrong, right? That's
right.
Where
that was where I was
play exactly like Pitt.
Exactly. I was like, oh no, it's happening again. Like, it was just not good. They were good. That's where I have the notes. Like, they were going cross court. The hitting was not there. Also, it was another match where D'Amico in the third set, her setting just started just slipping precipitously. And so they played a lot of Eloise Suarez in that set. Then the fourth set, it was a little bit better, only so much. I'll note for Pierce and Bosie, they combined for 17 kills and they both hit 419, which is what you want. Like, our middles haven't been really doing that, but that's what a middle should do, is hit a small amount under, like, 8 to 10 kills at a really high percentage. That's what Mogridge does that. She's hitting 448 in the matches that she's played so far. And the other two, Bosie and Pierce, have definitely not been doing that.
Not to be surprised by that, but I was kind of surprised because there's a couple times where I think it's more of a fault of the pass that Bosie got given, where, you know, not even a misplay. She just, I think, got credited as like an error or something like that. And so the fact that she was able to hit 419 despite that is a pretty good sign.
Yeah, there was,
I would say.
There was one or two that both Pierce and Bosie landed for kills that were just bad sets. Like, they got lucky. There were some they were definitely fortunate on. Let me go back to Bertolino serves. So at this point now, anytime she has a jump serve, I mark it down, and I mark down in play, ace, or how it was an error. She had 22 serves in the four over the four sets. 11 of them were returned in play. 7 aces, only 2 in the net, and only 1 went long. And, you know, 6 of those 22 were in that stretch in that fourth set, or in the first set. But it makes a huge difference, man. When she is on and hitting the ball in play, it makes a massive difference. Today against Notre Dame, she only had 10 serves total, and 8 in play, no aces. But honestly, we kind of didn't need it, and she float served like half of those anyways because she was able to do that. So also, her 50th ace was the first point of the match, and it came on a float serve. Like, one of those 7 aces was not a jump serve ace. So she's able to kind of use both in some capacity.
Yeah.
I would like to make a note there too, in terms of, you know, dropping the third set and all that. There was 4 times in a row where Bianca Bertolino, who extremely effective server, came to the line, and no serves resulted in points, not necessarily like service errors
set,
or anything like that,
third,
but just not being able to capitalize on her effectiveness in service. Again, you know, not necessarily the only reason that the third set didn't go Tech's way, and also the fourth one being very early in the fourth, but certainly I wouldn't say it helps. But they managed to, you know, it's one set, it's kind of like the randomness of the game of volleyball, but it's very interesting to see how the game and the narratives play out, because again, you look at you know, the De Beer performance on the other side, Jones, all that, you know, it comes down to how people play on a given day. And if Tech's middles, I think, being a big story here that I do want to reiterate just one more time before we, you know, kind of mosey along, is if they can do that without Mogridge in the middle, we've seen some aspects from Pierce, whether that's even in service, but just great vision for the court and putting the ball in places where the defenders are not. I think that really kind of highlights Tech's growth and is a good example of, you know, kind of what we were saying after Pitt, UGA, Miami, where it's like, hey, this team, and even tough wins like UVA or some of the other, you know, close 5 setter type wins that Tech has had, where it's like, hey, this team needs to get a little bit better XYZ. And I think we're starting to see that kind of come together, and not to force a transition to Notre Dame, but certainly it's something they continued into Sunday as well.
I agree. Yeah. Today Notre Dame is not one of the strong teams also at all in the ACC. Like, it was supposed to be a steamrolling, to put it lightly. And they did that. They won 25-17, 16, no, 25-16, 25-15, 25-14 today in those sets. And two of those, they had a 9-point run in the third set as well, 8 or 9 point run to close that out. So they took care of business. It was definitely a lot more of the same against the Notre Dame team, which has a former Georgia Tech player, Nicole Drunick, who started at setter for them and played all three sets, which was cool to see an old friend back. But yeah, no, today I don't want to beleaguer too much about today's match because it was just one of those take care of business kind of days. Like there's nothing really to be, not much to be learned from it outside of the fact that at this point, Liv Mogridge does, like I was told after the match on Friday, she was ready. Like she wanted to play badly. Like she's kind of like in that state where like, if you're if it's a playoff, she's playing, but if it's the regular season, you're not playing kind of deal right now.
Not to read between tea leaves on that, but it didn't look like she was walking all that smooth just from sitting in the building. And
she's
like,
walking. It's a lot.
It looked smoother. A way that like I played a decent amount of sports in my day, and it did not look like a way that I would say like, ah, yes, I'm ready to go. Yeah, if that makes sense.
Sure, sure. She's walking a lot better than the match where I noted where it looks like she may have re-aggravated her injury. But at this point, she's match to match. In terms of her availability. So there is actually a chance she plays against Pitt. I don't think it's a strong chance, but it's not an impossibility if she does well in practice this week. She's practicing. Like, she's, like, doing team activities and everything like that.
So. I think at a certain point, it's also gaining match fitness, right? You have to be, you can be practicing, and you have, after the injury, you just have to get back up to game speed.
Right.
And they might have her on that part of the recovery plan.
Let me do the notes from, these are all from Tech's press release after the Louisville game, because there was a lot of history that was made that night. This was the highest ranked win in team history, so like the best team ever beaten inside O'Keefe Gymnasium by ranking. This was the sixth time we've been a top 10 team. Four of those wins have been in the last 6 years, so Kalia doing a lot of the work there. That was our third top five victory. There was this one. We beat at number 2 Pitt in 2021 and then at number 5 Nebraska in 2003. That was when Kelly Evelyn was with the team. That was the second, the first time ever Tech has beaten two top 10 teams in the same season. So that's awesome. 25 straight sellouts of O'Keefe. Today was our, today's match against Notre Dame was our 100th win since we won the NIVC title.
Which is insane to think about, because I remember doing a podcast episode with Jake. I think it was the next day. It was either podcast or we were doing the write up for that, and we were just like, "Wow, this team has come so far." We think they kind of got snubbed from the NCAA tournament, and then they've basically run the table in this as one of the top teams in this makeshift NIT WNIT situation for volleyball. But it's so different. Like it's only been 4 years that
I've been cooking up a take all week since even before the Louisville game. I think that run and getting snubbed from the NCAA tournament is one of the best things that's ever happened to this team, because they had to go and play games against good, like South Dakota should have been a tournament team too. We played, I think, TCU in a match, like not everybody was a, isn't there? They're not all bangers, you know, but they played some good competition in must win matches for round of 64, 32, 16, 8, 4, and championship. Six must win matches in a row is a great way to steal the team. And you know, there's no one left from that run that is there, but there are people who benefited from going to the Elite Eight 2 years ago, Bianca Bertolino being one of them. And you know, that the team has to learn how to win and how to be consistent. And I think that this is kind of what I was asking about in my column a couple of weeks ago. Like, when is it okay to ask for more from a team? Hey, we've seen that you can beat the best of most conferences. Can you beat the best of our conference? And as of right now, Georgia Tech volleyball has bounced back from some inconsistency to beat one of the best teams on their schedule, a team that, for the record, they had not beaten since before I took a college final, and I have 2 degrees from Georgia Tech now. That was a long time ago. That was also a much, much worse Louisville team. But again, Georgia Tech sitting 12-2 atop the ACC in, well, a four-way tie, but we could get it. maybe some prognostication later. But they control their own destiny, right? They get Louisville again. They get another shot at Pitt, who clearly they took to five the last time around. And that was a Georgia Tech that, you know, maybe has done some growing since then. I think there's a lot to like right now. And sitting in a spot where with however many games left, I think it's four, right? They play 18. It's not that many. Actually, I have it right here. I'm just going to scroll down a little bit. They got Pitt, Miami, Syracuse, and Louisville. And for those counting at home, three of those four teams are in the top five. One of the others in the top five is, you know, Georgia Tech. And the other one is the worst team in the conference. That's a tough order, right? Yeah. Even though they control their own destiny, Louisville, it's in their building, a place that, kind of spoiling a point I was going to make a little bit later in the old podcast, Georgia Tech volleyball has never won at Louisville in the House of Pain. The LNN Federal Credit Union House of Pain or whatever.
The building for a credit union that no longer exists, for a railroad that no longer exists.
The credit union still exists. It's just the railroad that no mas. No trades, just close money. Which, no trades, you know, money. That's...
That speaks a lot about American history right there.
That says a lot about society right there. We live in a society, Mr. Grant.
We truly live in a society. Also, there's a railroad that like cuts through that building. I'm pretty sure it's like the successor railroad to the LNN. So, yeah, interesting place. But yeah, Tech is winless there. They got to go on the road and beat a very angry Louisville team. They host Pitt this Friday in the only ACC match they'll play this weekend. That Pitt team is getting Georgia Tech at 5 p.m., which I think is crucially different than 7 p.m., given...
Proud.
As a former student and a current working person in the city of Atlanta, that's before I'm off of work. Up.
I'm glad we get the ACC Network bump for one of these games, but at least for that game, but I am not glad that it had to force us up a time slot. If y'all want to
run the ACC Network,
I'll let y'all figure that out while I ramble a little bit. We're all time against Louisville. We're 0-8 on the road. Our win was only our fourth win ever against them in 18 matches against Louisville. Against Pitt, let me scroll down on my handy dandy cheat sheet that I have been making for myself for
Have a website for this. Come on, sir.
Yeah, mine's easier for me. We're 2-14 all time against Pitt. We've never beaten home.
I can tell you what is on ACC Network at 7 p.m.
Okay. Is it like some...
It's Florida, Virginia in men's basketball from Charlotte.
That's right.
So
basketball
it's
starts. Okay. That's right.
It's
basketball
in the preseason starts. Tournaments.
Not going to lie, I kind of get why they did that.
Followed immediately, by the way, by
basketball of them.
Followed immediately, by the way, by South Carolina VT, also from Charlotte. So, not my favorite scheduling decision. I get that one of those things makes far more money than the other, but it's incredibly stupid. These are two very good, if not excellent, volleyball programs right now.
Two top 10 volleyball programs, man. These excellence.
I mean,
the beginning of it.
Judging on what happens in the coaches poll tomorrow, it could be even higher than that, right? It's that
it did lose, so I think it'll still be a top 10 matchup.
It did lose to FSU.
FSU's
one of those four teams that's tied atop the ACC. So this is a quality win. And this gets to the other point I've been cooking up. The coaches poll, and this is true in football, it's true in baseball, it's true in golf, it was true in volleyball when Tech first got good, is that the coaches poll is inherently a conservative, not like politically conservative, but like a conservative, reactionary, lagging indicator of a team getting good. Florida State needs some love in this poll. They're 18-8 overall, which isn't necessarily world beating, but to be 12-2 in the conference, including a win over Pitt and darn near one over Georgia Tech, lest we forget, we had to win that in the absolute maximum length of volleyball game. Well, I guess there is no, you can always be one ahead forever, but
OT.
You know what I mean?
They went to OT. Five sets. I know what you mean.
Yeah. It took extra points.
Yeah,
it took
five
an extra
sets
point.
Playing to the end, but,
I want to see if they even got any votes. I don't think they got votes this past week, actually. Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. Like, I get it. They're 18-8, but like, I don't know. They beat Georgia, a team that beat Georgia Tech. Yes, they have a loss to future ACC team conference mate SMU. They got a loss to Auburn. Auburn's a Power Five team. UCF, good program, loss, a 5-set loss to a very good Florida team, 4-set loss to TCU, and three, and the TCU one was in TCU's building, and a 3-set yeah. loss to Hawaii. And then, like, Georgia Tech and Louisville are their only conference losses. Like, this That's is a good really, program, yeah. and they're playing yeah. their best volleyball of the year by far right now. So yeah. give Florida State some love, too.
I'm glad we don't have to play the. I'm going to forget that SMU is an ACC school while they're in the ACC multiple times. I know it, but I just had this thought in my head. Let's discuss this in the summer. But the addition of these three new schools probably does mean we only play Pitt and Louisville once next year each.
I don't even want to see what those schedules look like next
that's,
year.
That's why so let's talk about annoying. This will be an 8 months from now deal, but back in the mind.
I think I've already cracked what they're going to do, but we can get to that when we get there.
Later.
Pods. Anyway, we mentioned earlier that Georgia Tech controls its ACC championship destiny. There are four teams tied at the top of the standing. So that's Georgia Tech, Florida State, Louisville, and Pitt. All of them are 12-2 in conference. There are no tiebreakers used for the championship itself. There are tiebreakers used to determine the auto bid. There is no ACC conference tournament in volleyball that was eliminated many, many years ago. But the tiebreakers are not used to actually declare a champion. So the road for Georgia Tech to win the ACC title starts on Friday, November 10th, at that aforementioned 5 p.m. Versus Pitt. Florida State plays Syracuse that same day, and Louisville plays Duke. So that's on Friday. On the Sunday following that, Louisville plays North Carolina, Florida State plays Miami. The Friday following that, the 17th, Florida State plays Chicago State on an off weekend for them in ACC play, and Georgia Tech plays Miami. Louisville plays Pitt on the Saturday. And then Syracuse versus Georgia Tech, Florida State versus North Carolina the next week, Georgia Tech versus Louisville again, Miami versus Pitt. Anyway, I think reading the entire fixture list is not going to do anyone any good, so I'm going to stop there.
Well, basically what this says, though, is that Florida State, they're only, like, serious, like if you're, like, just pure, don't think, purely feels like only that Miami match feels like, feels threatening to them. Miami has beaten Tech this year. They can be really good at times. If they're going to lose, it's that match probably, and not any of their other ones. So their road to staying atop is really good because Pitt and Louisville play each other. We play Pitt and Louisville twice again. So they have a considerably easier path to holding that top. They may, just by the fact of Pitt, Louisville, and Tech eating each other alive, get that championship. They may get the auto bid by default.
that's key, right? There's no... there are only tiebreakers for the auto bid. Yeah. There are not tiebreakers for the actual championship. So it does matter. That run in does matter because it's just raw record.
But in the case where Georgia Tech, Pitt, and Louisville eat each other alive while FSU wins out, they won't need tiebreakers anyways because FSU would be alone at the top of the conference.
Right, that's what I was trying to say. Yeah,
that's what I'm trying to say.
And we'll have a weird situation where probably Pitt, Louisville, and Georgia Tech are hosting the first and second rounds, and Florida State, as the auto bid, is traveling somewhere.
Yep.
That's just volleyball, baby. Pew, 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 pew.
This sport has gotten so interesting this year in this conference, I gotta say.
The top four, the top five is fascinating. I don't know enough about other conferences in volleyball to say if they have a similar competition at the top. But to make everything back into soccer, this is like a very good year at the top of the Premier League table.
Make everything back into volleyball and remembering some, in this case, doodads. That 2019 Georgia Tech team finished second in the conference and finished second in a Power Five conference that included good Pitt Louisville programs and did not make the tournament. That shows you how far that's like, if you want to talk about 4 years of change, the ACC is a dominant, not, I don't know about dominant league in the sport, but certainly the top half of the conference can play there with anyone.
Like, I would say, yeah.
Ranking or not.
I'm just doing a quick scan of the other Power Five. Effectively, the Big Ten is Wisconsin or Nebraska. Whoever wins that match wins the championship. Pac-12, it's basically Oregon or Stanford. Whoever wins that game wins the championship. SEC, right now, actually, is a pretty much a three-way running between Kentucky, Tennessee, and Arkansas, who all, I don't know what the calendar mechanisms are left with them, but that is the only other notable Power Five. Let me look at the Big 12, but I think it's just us in the SEC in terms of top heavy. You don't know what's going to happen down the line kind of stuff here. So, Texas wins the Big 12 every year. Yeah. So in terms of the most top heavy, interesting volleyball in the country right now, yes, it is the ACC.
I love that the ACC is the Bundesliga of women's volleyball. It brings me so much joy.
Doesn't
because
Bayern
you know
win
that
every
it's
year?
Gonna be, it's going to be, yeah, that's the point that I was coming to. It's going to be, it's so much fun until one of the usual suspects, in which case it's probably going to be the Pitt Louisville, yeah, wins the conference at the end of the day.
Yeah.
It's so dumb. It's, I love it so much. It's so great. So again, Friday, 5 p.m. versus Pitt at O'Keefe, no game Sunday. Georgia Tech versus Pitt last time out, 3-2 win for Pitt. Pitt kind of stepped on the gas in the third set and didn't really let go of that game. So we're just going to have to see where this, how the cards shake out for this matchup. Other news and notes from around the flats. We will have some men's and women's basketball previews for your listening pleasure later this week. Just so we get the calendar, the fixture list out of the way here. Men's basketball will start their season versus Georgia Southern on Monday at 7:30, and then they will be back in action on Thursday. I believe that's the 9th versus Howard, also at 7:30. Women's basketball will start at the aforementioned 11 a.m. for Education Day on Monday versus Coastal Carolina, and then 2 p.m., I believe that's Saturday, versus Furman. Gentlemen, we have gone very long today. Any other news and notes before we wrap up here?
I got one note, and that's that someday I want a true doubleheader, men's and women's basketball. I think that would rule.
Yeah.
It would be even more fun. Picture this. True doubleheader of clean old-fashioned hate at the week before
State
Christmas.
Farm.
Not at State Farm. It would not sell at State Farm. Mm-hmm. At McCamish, like, it's the usual home and home structure, but they put the men at 2, they put the women at 4.
They used to have at the Omni every year clean old fashioned hate. So I think they do fine ticket sales wise.
But yeah, who knows?
I mean, it depends on if the Hawks want to give up the arena for a night. That's really the major factor. And now they don't have to worry about hockey. So
yeah.
Sad.
Womp womp. It's fine. Gentlemen, I think that about wraps it up for us today. Thank you again to Joey Weaver of Basketball Conference and from the Rumble Seat editor Emeritus for joining us today for Football Talk. Mr. Grant, where can the people find us on the internet?
The people can find us at fromtherumbleseat.com. We post these podcasts there, but we also post plenty of other content as well. Go check that out. Leave comments. You know, follow us on Twitter at FDRS blog. I'm at Jake Grant, 98Jax, at Jack Nicholas. You can also email us from therumbleseat@gmail.com. We want to hear from you with your news, notes, you know, future topics, content, things like that. No promises it'll get covered before next summer. It's particularly long, but we got a lot to talk about here. In the meantime, you can find Section 103 at Section 103 and Section103.com. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube at From the Rumble Seat, and you can find this podcast wherever fine podcasts are distributed. Tell your friends, like, subscribe, review, all those buzzwordy type words. Good night, good luck, and go Jackets.